Thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Stonebridge Church Podcast. Here at Stonebridge, our goal is to lead people into a real, healthy, and growing relationship with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to join us live, we hold services every Sunday at 9:30 and 11:05 at 1 Stonebridge Church Drive in the Woodlands, Texas. You can also stream our services online on our website, on our YouTube channel, and our church app. We invite you to check out our website at GoStonebridge.com and give us a like on Facebook at Facebook.com/GoStonebridge.
This week, Pastor Steve Bradley continues our series, Vertical Love. Now here's Pastor Steve.
All right, good morning. Glad y'all made the 8:30 service. I know a lot of people, you say, where are they? They'll be here, don't worry. They'll show up. Glad that you are here in the midst of the yellow snow called pollen in the pine trees of the Woodlands. We're talking about love, and we're talking about vertical love, talking about how God himself loves us and how that translates into our lives. And if you saw in your outline, the title this morning is Hurting in a Love Song. And does anybody remember there was a song called Hurting in a Love Song? Good. Okay. I know we show our age when we do that, but it was from a 70s Southern rock band called the Marshall Tucker Band. It goes, Hurting in a Love Song. Hurting in a Love Song. Can't be wrong, you know. So, and I thought I always loved that line in the song because I thought it was so good. Now, if you go back and listen to the song, it'll probably disappoint you because they play a flute to start out with. You're like, how could this be rock? He's playing a flute, you know. And it was just a different style back then that they did. But here's what, and when you go back and you listen to the song, that's all I remember about the song. And you go back and listen to the song, here's what was disappointing. The song is not what you think. It's not, you know, I heard all these romantic ideas and how wonderful it would be and that it would last forever. And I heard it in a love, you know, song. The song is actually written about a guy who does fall in love. He hits love. He understands it. But he always packs his bag and leaves and runs. Always. And he says, and he says something like, you know, I never said I loved you when it is true, but I got to pack my bag and go because, you know, so I'm not going to hang around because I'm just not going to do that. I'm going to move on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And, you know, there are a lot of songs about love and relationships written on both sides, you know, about it failing. You know, every country western song out there, right, is about a failed love, and I was cheated on, and, you know, they did me wrong. And all of these are emotions and things that we feel about love, especially when it comes to romantic love, when it comes to this love between a husband and a wife, or a man, you know, and a woman, and this that involves so much emotion. I will admit to you, of course, like every other person, there's this magic to it and this wonder to it that we all just kind of, you know, get wrapped up in, and this sort of I don't know, like a mental drug that gets, you know, becomes a part of you. And at a certain age, all the hormones kick in for the first time. And it's like, this will be the answer to everything. This will overcome and fix everything. And of course, all the wonderful songs and stories about young love that just abandon everything, you know, to chase after this, only to wake up one day and realize, okay, there was more to it. It didn't work quite that way. And then they write their own love songs about, you know, how it didn't work out. So those are all part of it. But so here's what I want to do, because even in this series, I thought that there's a tendency, as I said last week, in Christianity to look for still that kind of love, some peak, some mountaintop experience that I can stay on the mountaintop forever and never come down. But it doesn't work that way. And even when you look at love in the Bible and you talk about agape love, which is the word in the Greek language for the most common love, and yet it's used for God's love, which most writers, or a lot of writers, would say, so the writers just take it and they elevate it to a new status, to a new place. I don't think so. It's just my opinion. You know, you can like it or not like it. I don't think so. I think that the whole point of using agape and translating and understanding God's love that way is that kind of love is foundational to everything. And every other kind of love if it's going to last, if it's going to work, must be built on that type of love, that unconditional love, that giving of yourself. That becomes the foundation of love. So every other love relationship, if it's not built on that love, crumbles. And in one sense, it has to, because it has nothing to hold it up. One of the things I learned in counseling and reading the Bible and trying to help people was that romantic love is the most fragile of all loves. It is. And so because of that, it's the love that has to be protected in very specific ways in order to keep it from falling or being hurtful or being disappointing in life. And if you go back all the way back to the very beginning in the Bible, it's why even that love is put in a very exclusive place. But let me do this. Let me just start out by jumping in and saying, let me answer this one question. Why is it that marriage, which is a picture, of that love, it's what we call that kind of love. Why is it that marriage is so difficult sometimes? And it is. And it's so painful sometimes, and it's so disappointing sometimes. And yet at the same time, I want to go ahead and say, so wonderful. And maybe I can help by answering a few questions for you this morning. If you're already ready to send me an email, just hang on. I'll give you more reason before we're done. Here we go. Here's number one. Because marriage means exclusive love. And I think that it does. I think that's the promise of it, and I think that's the hope of it, and the wonder of it, and yet at the same time can be the struggle of it. Here's in Genesis chapter 2. So this is, the early narrative of God creating the world, and then he realizes that the man that he created was alone, and he says it's not a good thing for him to be alone. And I still will tell you guys, it's not a good thing for the man to be alone. When my wife goes out of town, which there are reasons that she does that, and including grandkids and everything else too, I can go and tell you, it's not good for a man to be alone. It's good for me to have basketball games or something to kind of lock onto in my boredom. And I like this passage because God creates the wife, the woman specifically, because of the man's need, but it was always a part of God's plan. And this is what it says in chapter 2, verse 23. The man, when he sees the woman brought to him by God for the very first time, she was created from his rib. Here's what he says. At last, the man exclaimed. Don't you like that? Because it's sort of the symbol also of his own need and his own frustration, looking at all of creation and not having someone who corresponds to him. And just to let you know, in the Hebrew, in Genesis, the word God says, I will make a helper for him, someone suitable for him. This is not a demeaning term. In fact, this term is often used in the Psalms for God as our help or as our helper. And it means someone who can match up with him, someone that is fitting to understand him and relate to him. And in this case, can relate to God in the same way that the man can relate. And that means everything that it speaks of the man in Genesis, when it's not just speaking of the man in a gender role, everything that's said of him means it's also being said of her at the same time, because this is man in the sense of man and woman. At last, he says, this one is, I like this, he says, this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. It's the same thing that you hear now of a guy, meeting a girl and deciding I fall in love, and he just goes, wow. It's the same thing. It's just his way of saying it. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Guys, you're welcome to say that, when you fall in love for the first time. I don't know if it'll be received, but you could try that. She will be called, now catch this, she will be called woman because she was taken from man. And even in a modern translation, like the New Living Translation, you, of course, in the English, you see the correlation of those two terms, man and woman, because woman contains man also. It's just the prefix on the word makes it now feminine, where before it was masculine. It is exactly the same In the Hebrew, except that it's a suffix, is added to the end of the word. And the word used here in the Hebrew for woman is the same word for man with a feminine suffix ending on the word to change that part of it. But it means the same, but female, where this was male. So it says in verse 24, and this is probably Moses, which most people believe Moses wrote Genesis, Moses' explanation, even in the translation of the language, where he says, this explains then why a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into what? Now, think about it. I want you to think about the picture. So she is created for him as someone who is suitable. She can match up. She can understand him. She knows how he thinks. He doesn't know how she thinks, but she understands how he thinks, and she can relate to him. And so there's this picture of this creation and them coming together and there being a reason for it, a purpose for it, a unity of it, and becoming one. What it does not mean, and I know you hear people say, well, I am a whole person, you know, without a man, or I'm a whole person without, of course you are. But there is a completeness in bringing them together that is not there by yourself. It's not. You cannot have kids by yourself. At least, you know, no one has ever come up with a way for you to, you know, be like a some single cell organism and just divide, you know, into another two organisms. It just doesn't work that way, and it's designed not to work that way. I will do this over and over again. I love to do this with couples to help them understand why it is so important for you to understand what God gives you when you find the person that you're going to spend the rest of your life with and you're going to commit yourself to for the rest of your life. Why this is so important. Your eyes, you have two eyes. Someone would say they're the same. They are in the sense that they're eyes. But if you go to an eye doctor, he will tell you your eyes are not the same. One is stronger and one is weaker. One sees a certain way. And because you have two eyes, your two eyes gain a new dimension in your perception, your vision. They both see the same thing, but they see the same thing from slightly different angles. And those two angles, which change the picture slightly, creates depth. It enables you to look at something and understand distance to something or how near something is. And if you just had one eye, you would only see things two-dimensionally. You would lack this perspective, which most of us say, well, it's not a big deal. Actually, it's an incredibly big deal. As far as how we function, the problem is we just don't think of it very often. We just sort of take it for granted. But God designs it that way, and bringing a man and a woman the same, absolutely the same, same promises given to them, same inheritance from God, same love for God, but they take on different roles and they have different perspectives is just an amazing thing that God actually does. But the key is they have to come together and be one. This is why love is so important. Otherwise, the differences that we have, how we see things differently, separate us. And this is why love in the marriage relationship is so vital. And I will tell you why I think love in its foundational level is so important in the marriage relationship. Because the other part of love that is in the relationship can be volatile. It can be much more emotional. This part of love, the foundational part of love, stabilizes it and keeps it on an even keel and keeps it strong and supportive. And we're going to talk about that in just a little bit more. But it's why most weddings probably. You know, if you've been to a wedding recently, you have heard 1 Corinthians 13, which we looked at last week, read in the wedding. Paul is not writing it about husbands and wives, but it has everything to do with the strength of the relationship. Without that, without be kind, be patient, and which means, we said this last week, which means that patience in its context means the capacity to be wronged and not retaliate. Without that, you're going to have a hard time making the other loves that are so emotional, so making them last and making them worth. This supports them. Okay, one last part of that verse. He goes on and adds, which is such a wonderful understanding. He says in verse 25, he says, "Now the man and the wife were both naked." Just want to see if there are any giggles. Okay, they were both naked, but they were not ashamed. And this means the fact that they felt no shame, it was that there was a sinlessness to them. And so in their nakedness, even though it's a literal thing, it represents the fact that there was nothing to be ashamed of in their relationship, and there was no fear in the relationship of being exploited. In other words, they were completely vulnerable, completely transparent to one another without any fear of being exploited. Now, after sin enters the world, all of that changes. But this was a part of the design that God had and part of his plan in putting them together. Here's number two, which I've already said, marriage must be protected. Of course it should, has to be. Of course this kind of love, above all other loves, must be protected more than any other kind of love, because it is the most vulnerable to attack, to exploitation, it's the most vulnerable to being misunderstood, for deep, deep feelings of resentment to all of a sudden show up and cause division in the marriage and the relationship, which is foundational even to our to all cultures. Here's what Hebrews says, verse 4 of chapter 13. Marriage should be honored by everyone, and husband and wife should keep their marriage pure. That's what he's talking about. There's an honor, a respect for it, and the marriage relationship should be kept protected. It should be kept pure within the marriage relationship itself. Here's number three. Marriage involves desire and attraction. That's one of the reasons why it can be difficult, because it involves desire and attraction. Now, a lot of people go back in the Bible and say, in fact, I was just reading C.S. Lewis, who is a generation ago and British, and so several things he talks about in his one of his books, which I understand, I would not agree with, but I understand. C.S. Lewis will say the idea of romantic love or even sexuality in the midst of love has little to do with marriage. I don't agree with him. But if you're British and you pretty much lived 100 years ago, I understand why you would see it that way, right? You've probably seen many British proper movies and understand it. That's how they see it. And then some people will go in and even say in the Bible, I had a really good friend that wrote a book on this that said marriages, you should not choose who you should marry. It should be arranged. And he tried to make a case for it, which I think is an incredibly weak case, trying to go back to the Bible and saying, you should just let your parents pick who you're going to marry. They're smarter than you are, he said. They know more what you really need and what you want. It would work out better. Anybody want to do that? I just want to know if there's anybody, because I'll talk to you afterwards a little bit further. And of course not. You would say, what are you talking about? How could you even conceive of something like that in the modern culture? And listen, go back in Genesis and read the stories of Abraham and Sarah, and then try to say there was no desire and no attraction. In fact, of all the early patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all three of their wives are described as physically being beautiful. All three of them are described that way. So there was clearly an attraction that each one had to his wife. And Jacob is probably, one of the most famous stories, because Jacob falls in love with Rachel, and Rachel's father is just, a really good, maybe not honest, businessman who works it and says, okay, if you'll work for 7 years, and then tricks Jacob and gives him the older sister, Leah, instead, and says, now you got to work 7 more years. And it says, even in the narrative, it says, and for Jacob, the first 7 years flew by like a day. Yeah. Tell me that's not desire, attraction. Of course it is. He was what we would call in love, He could not wait. He was so excited about this relationship, about having her as his wife, being joined with her forever. I mean, that it is such a part of who we are and such a necessary thing for us to deal with and to understand in everyday real life, because it has consequences, this part of the relationship. There's a really good book. It's pretty new, called Vertical Marriage. They stole my title and published it last year. Can you believe that? Vertical Marriage, and it's written by Dave and Ann Wilson. Dave is a pastor, one of two on a pretty big church. And it's just a wonderful book because it is so honest and open as far as their struggles in marriage, as well as the wonder. In fact, the subtitle at the bottom is The One Secret That Will Change Your Marriage. Now, does that get you interested, right? In fact, you know, I've read the book, and I know you might be thinking, well, what is the one secret? Because then you wouldn't have to read it. You know, I could just tell you, right? So hang on. The one secret, you'll have to read the book to get, because I'm not going to tell you. So there you go. I'll just kind of bait you on it. It's a really good book, and there's one place in here where Anne begins to talk about, very honest, about Dave's neck problem. And so I'm exposing his struggles, but every man can relate to this same struggle, because if an attractive woman walks in the room, a man's head will do what? He will have a neck problem, right? Now, what happens after that is a whole different thing, but it's a natural reaction. I still remember when James Dobson came out and he said, ladies, there's nothing he can do about it. It's biological. It's the way he is. The head will turn. Now, again, what happens after that's a different thing. She saw him as the neck turned and kept turning. And she struggled with that. Of course she did. Because she said, it made me feel like I wasn't enough for him. I wasn't attractive enough. That his desire was not exclusively for me. You know, all of those things have ramifications in the relationship. And as she said, when I would confront him with that, he would say, not true. I don't know what you're talking about. She said, in her opinion, he'd become so used to the neck turning and he had this neck problem. And then she had to begin to deal with it. And this is what she did. She, in her struggles, she would go to God and she would talk to God about this because it made her feel insecure. And she would say this, or she would say, I would hear God say this, Anne, do you trust me? And that was where she would go back to. And she would keep struggling with that, and she would have to answer, yes, I trust you. Because ultimately, she understood love was trusting God, believing God, that God loved her. And so I'll give you two quotes out of the book. Hopefully, they will get you to want to read the book, because I think it's worth reading. This is on page 183. She says this, I don't want to sum everything up as if a lifelong problem of fear and anxiety suddenly dissipated after only a short prayer. So she doesn't want to get you to think, you know, I had a prayer, God brought me this realization, everything's okay. No, these problems continued, but I had the peace and the hope to face them. I think it's key that she knew where to run and that God would take her through these things and would take them through these things. And she said, you know, she hoped that it would get better. And one time when they were on the beach, she said, well, at least it's not a topless beach. I know you think, you can't say that in church. Well, you know, that was what she thought. And then they went on a mission trip into Europe. And they ended up in, I think it was either Switzerland or Sweden. And part of the project was down on the beach. And of course, what do you think? What kind of beach did they go to? Yeah, that's where they ended up. And so she was like, oh, my goodness. But it was in that helped him come to some realizations and start to deal with this issue more. And later in this on the same page, she says this. She says, that trip was a turning point of sorts. For the first time, Dave began experiencing a real level of success with his, say it with me, his what? Yeah, his neck problem, right? Didn't have to go to a doctor. And for the first time, I started realizing, catch this is great. I started realizing that my worth does not originate, cannot be increased, and certainly is not limited in any way to my physical appearance. I want you to catch that. This is something that we all struggle with in some ways, but it's such an important thing to catch what she's saying. She said, I realize that my worth does not originate, cannot be increased, and certainly is not limited in any way to my physical appearance. I don't know any other way that you can come to some of these conclusions without going through some of the struggles and the things even that she went through and being honest about them and saying, this is where I found my strength from. This is where I found my hope and my peace from. It, to me, is just such an encouraging thing and such a worthwhile thing to read and to think about and listen to and to go to God with, understanding that, of course, marriage involves desire and an attraction. And of course, all of us want to be wanted. All of us want to be desired in life. Of course we do. It's a natural thing for us. Who doesn't want that? And that God understands that, and God comes in and God makes a difference in that. Here's number four. A marriage sometimes feels one-sided. This will take you a little bit back to Genesis, but here's what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians. However, in the Lord, neither is woman independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as the woman originates from the man, so also the man has his birth through the woman, and all things originate from, say it with me, from who? Yeah, from God himself. So God creates for a reason. God creates, there's a purpose in it. It's not just equal in how it functions, but it is certainly there's an equality in how God loves us, how God gives to us, and how God is faithful to us in those roles and circumstances that we find ourselves in, because we need each other. And God has designed it that we need each other, and that we cannot make it, we cannot function without each other. Now, I say that because I know anytime you go through a broken relationship or any kind of struggle, which, listen, all of us go through it just to different degrees, that it can be also painful, and it can seem unfair. But there is a fairness that God himself brings to the equation that only God can bring the equation, because he watches over us. He watches after us. He cares for us. And here's number five. The heart of marriage must also be protected. In fact, the heart of marriage is probably the most important thing that must be protected within the marriage. And that means understanding, you know, the heart of the marriage. Here's what Paul says in Ephesians. This is the fourth chapter, and I think one of the reasons this is such a great thing to go back and read, again, understanding relationships, is because in the fifth chapter, Paul comes back and he begins to deal with giving ourselves to one another, mutually submitting to one another, and then he comes up in the fifth chapter and says, and wives, submit yourself, give yourself to your husband. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And it's where a lot of people go in and establish what they would consider the roles of marriage. I would disagree. I think this is where Paul is going in and he's establishing the response in marriage to what God has given you and how you respond to the other person in giving yourself to them. And he's working through those in there. But before he gets to that, in the fourth chapter, Paul is setting it up with some things that are more general, but yet are very specific, again, when you apply them to this relationship. Here's what he says in verse 26. He says, and don't sin by letting, say this one with me, don't sin by letting what? Anger control you. Listen, I can't think of any more applicable thing to say to a lot of couples by don't, it comes from the verse that says, you can be angry, but don't, you know, without sinning. In other words, there's a place for anger. There's a place for being upset. You can say, this hurts my feelings. That's not the same thing as when anger begins to control you and anger takes over. And you are no longer in control. You're no longer just reacting. Now it causes you to react in a certain way. He says, don't let the sun go down while you are still angry. He says, for anger gives a foothold to who? The enemy, the devil, the one who's not out to help you. You're giving him a foothold. Now, I say that if you are in a relationship, if you're in a marriage, and a lot of people, you know, can look back at this and say, yeah, you know, I just let anger get the best of me. You have to find a way. You have to find a way to get past that. If it means putting aside some of your preferences, put aside those preferences. If it means going in and saying that I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done this, I wasn't considerate of your view, of your feelings, you need to do that. Because without it, anger will gain a foothold and cause destruction in the relationship. There's a couple, they did a lot of work years and years ago called the Gottmans. And what they came up with a term called the four apocalypse. Or I'm sorry, now I'm blank. Not the four. The four horsemen of divorce. And this is what they did. They measured, as psychologists will do, responses, and they found when responses were this way, that the likelihood of divorce went up, and they were really accurate in their ability to predict a marriage's failure. And here's what they came up with. They said, so it's okay to complain about some things, but when complaint goes to criticism, and criticism means I start impugning the character of the person. I start saying, no, you are just, you know, and when it goes there, it breeds more anger. When it goes to contempt, which is a further step, and you think, why would there be contempt in marriage, in somebody you're loving? Because again, it is such a vulnerable thing, that kind of love, and it can easily go there because you expect so much of the relationship and of the person. It can easily go to a bad place. And then they came up with two other things, which were really responses to those two, but just as destructive, but which you could easily justify. The first one was defensiveness. So something comes up, the other person complains, and all of a sudden, or criticizes, and you become defensive. So there's no way to work through the issues, or what they would call a stonewalling. In other words, I'm just not going to say anything. I'm just going to act like I don't hear you. Just go about my life. Which is, again, a further negative response to contempt in a relationship. And all it does is create more and more struggles and problems and destroys the relationship more and more and more. And this is exactly what Paul is saying. Don't go there. You don't want to do this. You have got to find a way past those things and to get past those things. Then he adds, look at verse 31. He says, but get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, harsh words, and slander, as well as all types of evil behavior. Get rid of those things. Put those things aside. And instead, he adds this. Instead, say this part with me. Instead, do what? Be kind to one another. Say that again. Instead, do what? Yeah, show kindness to one another. That's the patience thing. The next one, do what? Be tenderhearted. That means you are trying to understand their feelings, how they see it. This is the oneness, the way the oneness should be. I don't see it that way. It's not the natural way that I would respond to it, but because you see it this way, I want to understand the way you see it. That's important to me. Forgiving each other, he says. Forgiving each other. Here's the reason. Just as God through Christ has done what? Has forgiven you. Yeah, listen, if God can be wronged and yet not retaliate against us, if God can forgive, then of course, what does he want to teach his kids to do? To learn how to forgive. If forgiveness is absolutely critical in our relationship with God, Without it, without God forgiving us, there would be no relationship between us and God. If it is absolutely critical in our relationship with God, why wouldn't it be absolutely critical in a relationship between a husband and a wife? Why wouldn't it be? And why wouldn't it be one of those things that we would realize we have to learn and we have to work on in order to make that relationship work? Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we thank you. You have plans for us, and so many times, Lord, we admit that we don't understand the plans. We mess up the plans. It's just easy for us to give up on the plans and until you draw us back to yourself. And then we realize that you are not a God, a Father, who loves and then walks away. But you continue to love us through every struggle, through every fight, through every discouraging thing that we encounter. The hope is still there because the love is still there because of how much you sustain us and you stay with us. And so, Father, we thank you for your faithfulness. Pray, Lord, that you would help us, that we would draw closer to you, and that we would rely on your great love and your comfort. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.